In 2006, India rolled out this incredible miracle medical intervention,
Yeah.
right? One that saved just countless children from a deadly brain swelling virus.
Yeah, it was, I mean, it was a massive triumph, the kind of victory where you just want to celebrate and, you know, close the textbook forever.
Exactly. You want to pack up the lab equipment and say mission accomplished. But 20 years later, that exact same public health triumph accidentally engineered, well, one of the deadliest, entirely invisible workplace hazards on
You
Earth.
really did.
So, welcome to the deep dive. Today, we have a mission for you. We are going to explore how Japanese encephalitis, a virus we really thought we understood, has completely shape-shifted into this modern occupational crisis.
Right, and we're pulling our insights today from a really massive, brand new systematic review. It was actually just published this month, April
Oh,
2026.
wow. So, literally brand new.
Yeah, fresh off the presses in the Australian Journal of Agricultural, Veterinary, and Animal Sciences. And it paints this picture of a disease that didn't disappear at all. It just, you know, changed its target.
Right. And just to give you, the listeners, a sense of the sheer scale we're talking about here, despite decades of global vaccination efforts, these new models estimate there are still about 100,000 cases of Japanese encephalitis, or JE, globally every single year.
Which is a staggering number for a vaccine-preventable disease.
It really is.
Yeah.
And in India, the burden is just colossal, but it's also highly concentrated, right? You have just five states. So that's Assam, Bihar, Tamil Nadu, Uttar Pradesh, and West Bengal, carrying almost 80% of the entire national caseload.
Yeah, and the geographic concentration is intense. I mean, Assam alone can account for 51% of nationally reported cases when an epidemic hits.
Over half in one state? That's wild.
It is. But here's the core issue the review highlights. Historically, Japanese encephalitis was universally classified as a pediatric disease, like a child's illness.
Right, it mainly hit kids.
Exactly. It devastated young children, tearing through communities, high mortality, severe neurological damage. But the data synthesized in this new 2026 review reveals this really profound epidemiological pivot.
Meaning the virus moved on from kids.
Yeah. JE is no longer just a childhood threat. It's completely transformed into a highly lethal and largely unrecognized occupational hazard for India's adult agricultural workforce.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because to understand how a disease just jumps from children to working adults, we really have to look back at that 2006 intervention we mentioned.
Right, the turning point. So in 2006, they introduced the SA14-14-2 vaccine.
Catchy name.
Right. But it was a live attenuated vaccine. That means scientists took the actual virus, weakened it in a lab so it couldn't cause the disease, and basically used it to give the human immune system a harmless practice run.
Got it. So it trains the body.
Exactly. And the rollout in India was aggressively targeted at children, specifically between the ages of 1 and 15.
And it worked, right?
Oh, phenomenally well. As a pediatric initiative, it was a massive success. Infection rates, mortality among kids in these highly endemic areas, they just plummeted.
It reminds me of it's like waterproofing the roof of a house. You put up this impenetrable barrier, and the rain stops coming in through the ceiling.
That's a great way to look at it.
Right, but the storm outside hasn't actually stopped. The rain is still falling, and water, you know, it just follows the path of least resistance until it finds the next vulnerable spot, the unsealed walls.
Exactly. The vaccine protected the children perfectly, but it did absolutely nothing to remove the actual virus from the physical environment.
So the epidemiological burden just displaced itself. It shifted entirely onto the adults who never got the vaccine in the first place.
Yeah, the surveillance data shows this demographic displacement so clearly, especially the large-scale cohort studies coming out of Uttar Pradesh.
What exactly did those show?
They showed the disease burden simply shifting to the unprotected adult population, specifically adult males who were engaged in outdoor agricultural activities.
Working in the fields, basically.
Right. And the severity is just alarming. The review notes that during epidemics, mortality in these adult cohorts can reach 42%.
Wait, really? 42%?
Yeah, almost half.
That is, I mean, 42% mortality for people who are just trying to do their jobs. When we hear the phrase occupational hazard, you usually picture something industrial.
Right, like a factory accident.
Yeah. You think of scaffolding collapsing on a construction site, or, you know, a chemical spill, or even just chronic burnout in an office. But for millions of agricultural workers in India, the most lethal workplace hazard is entirely invisible.
Completely airborne.
Airborne, and deeply embedded in the soil they till every day.
And if we want to connect this to the bigger picture, we really have to view this crisis through the framework of One Health.
One Health. What does that mean in this context?
So One Health is this fundamental epidemiological concept. It emphasizes that human health, animal health, and environmental health are all inextricably linked.
Like a triangle, sort of.
Exactly. You cannot isolate the human patient from the ecosystem they live in. And for Japanese encephalitis, the required ecological blueprint for the virus to actually thrive is highly, highly specific.
Right. It needs the perfect conditions.
Yes. The review pinpoints the ultimate high-risk landscape. It's areas where fragmented rain-fed agriculture violently collides with natural wetlands.
Okay, let's break down why that specific combination is so lethal. Fragmented rain-fed agriculture. So we aren't talking about massive industrial farms, right?
No, not at all. No subterranean drainage pipes or controlled irrigation here.
Right. We are talking about small patchwork plots of farmland. They rely entirely on the monsoon rains, and they're mixed right into naturally marshy, low-lying wetlands.
Yeah, which basically creates an endless mosaic of shallow, warm, stagnant water.
The ultimate mosquito paradise.
Exactly. And within those stagnant pools, you have this incredibly complex biological assembly line churning out the virus.
Because the pathogen doesn't just, like, leap from a puddle into a human bloodstream, right?
No, it requires a highly coordinated sequence of biological hosts.
It's essentially an unwanted biological relay race. And based on the sources, the domestic pigs in these farming communities act as the primary factories.
They do. The domestic pigs contract the virus, but, and this is key, they don't actually get sick or die from it.
Oh, wow. So they're just carriers.
Worse than that, their bodies act as perfect amplifiers. They flood their own bloodstream with massive quantities of the virus. Epidemiologists call the state hyperemia.
Hyperemia, so yeah. They become walking, breathing reservoirs of JE.
Exactly. But a pig can't transmit the virus to a human directly.
Right. The virus needs a transport division. It needs to move the product around. And that's where the wild wading birds come in, right?
Yes, specifically the Ardidae family. So your herons, your egrets.
So they feed in these marshy areas, pick up the virus, and carry it across geographic distances, seeding entirely new areas.
Precisely. Yet even with the pigs manufacturing the virus and the birds acting as transport, the assembly line still needs a delivery mechanism, something to physically inject it into the human workforce.
The baton passers. The mosquitoes.
Yes. The Culex mosquitoes, primarily the species Culex cratenurhincus and Culex gelidus.
Quite a mouthful.
Yeah, but they do the heavy lifting. They bite the highly viremic pig, draw the infected blood, and then fly off to bite the farmer working in the adjacent field.
So the humans aren't actually part of the virus's plan?
No, humans are actually considered dead-end hosts. The virus doesn't need us to continue its life cycle at all. We just happen to be standing on the factory floor when the delivery goes out.
And proximity to that factory floor is everything.
Yeah.
There was this highly specific and honestly memorable detail from an Assam case control study in the review.
Oh, the 100-meter rule.
Yes. They put a hard number on the risk. They found that living or working within just 100 meters of a paddy field significantly increases your risk of contracting JE.
I mean, 100 meters is essentially the length of a football field.
Right. It's nothing.
If your daily life intersects with the rice paddy and domestic pigs within that radius, you are standing in the direct center of the transmission cycle.
So the environment is perfectly rigged to breed the virus. But the danger multiplies exponentially during a very specific window of the year, doesn't it?
It does. The monsoon season.
Right. Which typically runs from June to August. And it acts as a massive catalyst.
Yeah, the heavy rains completely waterlog the paddy fields and the dirt areas surrounding the pig shelters. This triggers a literal population explosion of those Culex mosquitoes.
And the really tragic overlap here, the expert catchphrase moment, right?
Yeah.
Is that this exact window, June to August, is also the absolute peak of the agricultural labor season.
Yeah. Maximum mosquito density aligns perfectly with maximum human density in the fields, because that's when the planting and transplanting of the rice crops happens.
The workers are stepping into the biological assembly line at the exact moment production is running at peak capacity.
Precisely.
So the trap is set. Millions of workers are stepping into it every single day. The review identifies the specific high-risk groups, right? Paddy cultivators, pig-rearing households, and tea garden workers, particularly in Upper Assam.
Yes, those are the most vulnerable demographics.
But okay, let me play devil's advocate for a second here.
Sure.
If I'm a farmer and I'm out in the fields getting chewed up by swarms of mosquitoes every single day, my first priority is going to be protecting myself.
Right, buying bug spray, wearing long sleeves.
Exactly, or getting a bed net. If these workers are out there every day surrounded by mosquitoes, why aren't they protecting themselves? Is it just a lack of access to bug spray? Or is there a deeper psychological disconnect?
You know, you would naturally assume it comes down to purely financial access, just poverty.
Right, that they just can't afford the repellents.
But the systematic review pulls this fascinating qualitative data from Uttar Pradesh that reveals a much deeper behavioral barrier.
Oh, really? Like what?
When researchers went in and actually interviewed these communities, they discovered this profound disconnect. The workers fundamentally do not link their severe illness to mosquitoes, nor do they link it to their domestic pigs.
Wait, they don't know it's from the mosquitoes. What do they think is making them sick?
They largely attribute Japanese encephalitis to abstract concepts like filth or dirty water.
Filth. Wow. But you know what? If you think about it from their perspective, that's actually a highly logical deduction.
It really is.
They spend all day working waist-deep in muddy, foul-smelling swamp water mixed with agricultural runoff and animal waste.
Exactly.
And then they get a sudden fever and brain swelling. Blaming the visible filth makes perfect sense when you don't have a microscopic lens to see the tiny vector actually carrying the pathogen.
That's spot on. Human behavior is entirely dictated by belief. If your foundational belief is that environmental dirt and stagnant water are directly causing the illness, well, a mosquito net seems completely useless.
Right. Why would you use a net if you think the mud is making you sick?
Exactly. You aren't going to spend your limited income on insect repellent if you don't view the insect as the weapon. The microscopic nature of the transmission cycle completely shields the true hazard from the workers' awareness.
And that deeply ingrained misconception just traps them in the hazard.
It does.
And the review breaks down the demographics of who exactly is trapped, which brings up a really staggering statistic regarding the tea gardens of Assam.
Yes, the gender divide.
Yeah. We conventionally picture rugged outdoor occupational hazards as skewing heavily male, but the gender divide in this specific agricultural sector flips that assumption completely on its head.
The numbers are pretty stark.
The data shows that 94.38% of female tea garden workers are engaged in outdoor field work, compared to only 80.83% of males.
Right. And to understand why that divide exists, you really have to look at the historical division of labor in tea estates.
How far back does that go?
Going all the way back to the colonial era, the actual plucking of the tea leaves has almost exclusively been assigned to women.
Why is that?
There's this persistent industry belief that women possess better manual dexterity for delicately picking the two leaves and a bud required for high-quality tea.
Oh, interesting. And the men?
Men are more frequently assigned to factory processing or heavier pruning tasks, which are often indoors or less exposed.
So you have a workforce primarily made of women spending 8 to 10 hours a day physically immersed in dense, damp tea bushes, surrounded by the exact microclimates where these Killex mosquitoes breed.
Yes, constantly exposed.
The review notes, they're exposed to all sorts of biological hazards, leech bites, endless insect bites, yet there's almost no formal reporting of mosquito-borne illnesses from these women to the health clinics. Why aren't they reporting it?
Well, the lack of formal reporting rarely means an absence of disease.
Right.
It almost certainly indicates that these female workers are just powering through severe viral symptoms. They are operating under immense economic pressure.
Taking a day off to travel to a clinic means losing a day's wage.
Exactly. Which simply isn't an option for survival. The economic necessity aggressively overrules the biological hazard.
What's fascinating here is how economic disadvantage doesn't just keep people working while sick. It actually dictates their physical geography. It forces them to live inside that 100-meter danger zone we talked about earlier.
Yes, and you see this most clearly with the pig-rearing communities.
Right, the amplifying hosts.
Pig ownership in many of these northern and northeastern Indian states is highly concentrated among socially marginalized and economically disadvantaged groups.
It's basically a vital, highly liquid financial asset for them, like a walking savings account.
That's exactly what it is. However, because of deeply entrenched social stratification and, you know, stigmas associated with handling pigs, these communities are often pushed to the physical periphery of the villages.
And the periphery of the village is exactly where the human settlement bleeds into the natural wetlands and the flooded paddies.
Yes. They are forced by social and economic pressure to live exactly where the environmental risk is at its absolute peak.
They rely on the biological amplifier, the pig, for their financial survival, while living in the perfect breeding ground for the mosquito.
It's a really brutal, inescapable loop of economic marginalization and biological exposure.
The workers are entirely trapped.
Yeah.
But perhaps the most alarming section of this systematic review deals with the massive institutional blind spots of the systems that are supposed to catch them when they fall.
You're talking about the healthcare system.
Yeah. The system itself is operating with devastating knowledge gaps.
It really is.
The statistics on healthcare worker knowledge honestly stopped me in my tracks. The review cited a study evaluating hospital staff in Assam, and remember, this is a state that handles half the national epidemic burden.
Right, they should be the experts.
You'd think, but 79% of the surveyed healthcare workers relied on television broadcasts for their information regarding the zoonotic transmission of Japanese encephalitis.
Which is just wild.
Television, not professional medical training, not updated public health bulletins from the government, TV.
And it gets worse. 70.7% of them incorrectly believed that antibiotics are a primary treatment for JE.
Yeah, and medically speaking, prescribing antibiotics for Japanese encephalitis is fundamentally useless.
Because it's a virus.
Exactly. JE is a viral infection. Antibiotics target bacteria. They do absolutely nothing to halt the virus. It is the medical equivalent of throwing a bucket of water on a grease fire.
It fails to address the root cause and just wastes incredibly precious time. It highlights a catastrophic failure in continuing medical education and occupational health preparedness in regions where this virus is hyper-endemic.
And if the hospital staff doesn't fully grasp the mechanism of the disease, the patient's chances of survival just plummet, especially since the patients are already arriving at a severe disadvantage.
Right, because of how long they wait to seek help.
Right. What did the review say about that delay?
It found that agricultural workers routinely wait 7 to 10 days after the onset of severe symptoms before they even attempt to access formal health care.
7 to 10 days. With Japanese encephalitis, we are talking about acute encephalitis syndrome, or AES. For you listening, this isn't just a bad fever. This is severe aggressive inflammation of the brain tissue.
It causes confusion, debilitating seizures, and a rapid decline in neurological function.
Waiting a week with a swelling brain is catastrophic. Why are they waiting so long?
They delay because formal hospitals are often geographically distant. They're expensive to reach and, frankly, culturally intimidating.
So they go somewhere else first.
Yeah. Workers rely first on non-formal local providers or traditional remedies. By the time the worker finally arrives at a regional hospital experiencing full-blown acute encephalitis syndrome, the critical window for supportive, life-saving care has essentially closed.
It's tragic. And sitting above the vulnerable workers and above the under-equipped local clinics is a massive, gaping policy vacuum.
A huge one.
As we discussed at the start of this deep dive, because of the historical legacy of the disease, Japanese encephalitis is still rigidly classified in the broad public consciousness and, crucially, in government policy as a pediatric issue.
The policy framework is frozen in the past. It just hasn't caught up to the new epidemiological reality outlined in this 2026 review.
It's still stuck in 2005.
Exactly. Because it's viewed as a childhood disease, adult vaccination programs targeting these high-risk agrarian workers are essentially non-existent. Furthermore, the informal nature of fragmented agriculture means there are no targeted occupational safety nets. You do not have workplace health and safety inspectors trekking out to the rain-fed paddy fields to, you know, mandate the use of repellents and force protective clothing or monitor vector control.
The workers are completely off the grid when it comes to occupational protection.
Entirely.
So what does this all mean for you listening? The story of Japanese encephalitis in India serves as a stark, urgent reminder that a public health intervention, even a massively successful one like the 2006 pediatric vaccine rollout, is never truly the end of the story.
You don't just win and walk away.
Right. Viruses are not static entities. They are highly opportunistic. They adapt to our agricultural systems. They exploit our economic structures. And they nest right in our blind spots. We have to start treating Japanese encephalitis not just as a tropical medical curiosity, but as a severe, ongoing occupational health and safety crisis.
Absolutely. And as long as profound economic disadvantage forces human beings to work unprotected in these highly fragmented, rain-fed ecosystems, the virus is going to continue to find its human hosts.
We basically built the machine for it.
We did. We altered the environment with our farming practices. We altered the demographics with our pediatric vaccines. But the biological assembly line is still running at full capacity.
Right.
Until governments and health organizations integrate adult vaccination and serious occupational health measures into these agrarian sectors, the adult workforce will continue to suffer in the shadows.
I want to leave you with a final lingering thought today. There was a very quiet detail buried deep in the source material that paints a deeply unsettling picture of the future.
Oh, the Kerala study.
Yes. The systematic review briefly mentioned a separate serological study conducted down in Kerala in southern India.
And just for context, a serological study involved testing blood samples to look for the antibody signatures of past infections.
Right. It reveals what has actually been circulating in a population over time.
Exactly.
So they were testing workers in these exact same coastal agricultural districts. And they found that West Nile virus was actually more prevalent, sitting at a 21.5% positivity rate, than Japanese encephalitis, which was at 15.9%.
Which is a huge deal. West Nile is another major neuroinvasive virus, and finding it at those levels means it is experiencing completely silent circulation.
It's circulating completely under the radar in these exact same agrarian conditions. Think about that waterproofing metaphor one last time. We patched the roof for JE and kids, and the water found the adults. But what else is raining down on that house?
A lot, apparently.
If fragmented agricultural environments are currently serving as an invisible, silent incubator for West Nile virus, while all of our policy attention and funding is entirely focused on Japanese encephalitis, what happens when these shifting agricultural borders, driven by climate change and urban sprawl, finally creep into our major metropolitan centers?
It's a terrifying thought.
What other silent viruses are currently clocking in for a shift in the paddy fields right now, just waiting for their own demographic shift?
It's a profound question, and one that the field of occupational epidemiology is going to have to answer very soon, before the next silent incubator becomes a deafening crisis.
We'll leave you to chew on that one. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the sources, and we'll catch you next time.